The 1998 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 112, Joseph Smith's Family Dynamics, a paper presented by Dan Vogel with comments by C. Jess Groesbeck, chaired by Paul Tinker. This is a 60-minute session taped on a 90-minute tape, so the last half of the backside will be blank.
Time we can go ahead and begin. This is session number 112. Entitled Joseph Smith's Family Dynamics. We welcome you to the first regular breakout session of the symposium this year. I'm asked to remind you that admission to these sessions is by ticket or name card, and that registration is available across the foyer. Is Jess here someplace? I don't see Jess, our respondent. Has anybody seen him? Runs late and so may come dashing in. We'll hope that he gets to hear most of Dan's presentation. Let me go ahead and introduce our presenter this morning, who is no stranger to many of you, one of the seminal writers and thinkers in early Mormon studies. Dan Vogel, who has a bachelor's in history from Cal State in Long Beach, and a long list of publications and writings. It would take us the whole session to go through all of these, so I won't do that, except to mention a couple of his most significant publications. His book, which startled me to reflect that it was 10 years ago now, Religious Seekers and the Advent of Mormonism, which Signature published back in 1988. More recently, and I think many of you are aware of this, his very significant publication of Early Mormon Documents, Volume 1, which last year won the Mormon History Association's Steve Christensen Award for the Best Documentary. That award was presented a year ago at MHA. Dan is going to be speaking to us, as I said, on Joseph Smith's Family Dynamics. Our response, if Jess gets here, which I assume he will, is by Dr. Jess Groesbeck, a psychiatrist with an MD degree. There he is, just coming in. MD from the University of Washington, and who has written some and talked about some very interesting things in this same field, approaching the Joseph Smith experience from a Jungian perspective. So I think we're in for a very interesting discussion this morning. And without further ado, Dan, if you'll go ahead.
In a 1943 letter to S.A. Burgess, Dale Morgan wrote, "I think Joseph Smith was a man subjected to a singular environmental pressure, and that his behavior must be interpreted as an effect of this pressure upon distinctive psychophysiological components of his character." This essay will argue that the singular environmental pressure motivating Smith's behavior came primarily from his own family, and that Smith began his religious career in part to resolve family conflict. An examination of Joseph Smith in the context of his family environment has been largely neglected, and his relationship with his parents barely explored. Since the late 1950s, family therapists have become increasingly aware of the importance of understanding the individual within the context of his or her family of origin. My approach to Joseph Smith is informed by family systems theory, which views the family as an organism-like system that seeks to maintain emotional equilibrium or homeostasis. In a dysfunctional family, a family where one or both of the parents are emotionally impaired, the family system seeks balance in erotic or even pathological ways. An imbalance between the parents greatly affects the family system, especially the children, who usually seek to save the marriage. I would argue that the marriage relationship of Joseph Smith's parents, Lucy and Joseph Sr., like so many marriages, was essentially dysfunctional, that it was marked by religious conflict and severe financial burden, and that this had occurred even before Joseph Jr.'s birth on the 23rd of December, 1805, in Sharon, Vermont. It was Joseph Sr.'s ginseng misadventure and inept business management that caused their store in Randolph to collapse, eventually forcing them to sell their Tunbridge farm, probably in 1803 or 1804, to liquidate their debts. Their marriage in 1796 had begun with favorable circumstances, having property given them by Aziel Smith and a present of $1,000 by Lucy's brother and business partner. Already overextended financially, Joseph Sr. unwisely chose to invest all his proceeds on a ginseng venture to China, rather than pay his creditors in the usual fashion. It was a gamble, and he lost. Left penniless and propertyless, Joseph and Lucy took refuge on her father's land in Sharon. If Lucy did not feel some resentment towards her husband, Joseph Sr. was undoubtedly humiliated by the experience. Also, prior to their residence in Sharon, Joseph Sr. and Lucy's differing religious views had surfaced. Under pressure from his father and older brother, Joseph Sr. had requested Lucy to stop attending the local Methodist camp meetings. Lucy obeyed her husband, but later said she was very much hurt by his actions, although at the time she kept her feelings to herself. Lucy likely resented her husband's lack of support, for he had put the feelings of his father and brother before hers. But there was more to their religious differences than Lucy is willing to reveal in her history. Early in their marriage, Joseph Sr., along with his father Aziel and eldest brother Jesse, helped found a Universalist society in Tunbridge, Vermont. Although he may have at times flirted with Methodism, he was seriously committed to the Universalist doctrine. Son William wrote that his father's belief in universal salvation often brought him in contact with the advocates of the doctrine of endless misery. Joseph Sr.'s Universalism sharply conflicted with Lucy's New England Puritan leanings, which eventually drew her to the Presbyterian Church. Although vague about her husband's religious beliefs, Lucy nevertheless hinted that there was conflict, stating that in response to her husband's request to discontinue attending the revival meetings, she prayed to the Lord that he would so influence the heart of my husband that he would one day be induced to receive the gospel whenever it was preached. Stripped of its appeal to an LDS audience, the statement reveals Lucy's desire for her own religious views to prevail, and through the Book of Mormon, they eventually did. Contributing to the dysfunctionality of their marriage was Lucy's admitted periodic bouts with depression and suicidal fantasies, and Joseph Sr.'s struggle with low self-esteem and alcoholism. Following the death of her sister Levina, probably in 1794, the 19-year-old Lucy fell into a deep depression, which she later recalled had the effect of preying upon my health and was likely to be a serious injury to me. I did not feel as though life was worth seeking after. In less than 2 years, she had married, but was still experiencing what she called an aching void within. Despite a deep and abiding faith in God, Joseph Sr. evidently struggled with a drinking problem. Before his assembled family in 1834, Joseph Sr. expressed some misgivings about his past, both as a father and a husband. "I have not always set that example before my family that I ought," he said. "I have not been diligent in teaching them the commandments of the Lord, but have rather manifested a light and trifling mind, which has been a cause of grief to my family." His lack of attention to the commandments was likely due in part to his belief in universal salvation. When blessing his son Hiram at this family gathering, Joseph Sr. revealed a specific behavior that had distressed his family. "Thou hast always stood by thy father and reached forth the helping hand to lift him up when he was in affliction. And though he has been out of the way through wine, thou hast never forsaken him nor left him to scorn." Joseph Sr.'s drinking must have been considerable for him to have acknowledged it as a family problem. Certainly, it seriously impaired his ability to connect with others and contributed to his emotional unavailability to his wife and children. Lucy did not complain about her husband's excessive drinking in her history, but Joseph Sr.'s blessing on Hiram implies that he was special in not scorning his father for this weakness. In many ways, Joseph Sr. was not unlike Lucy's own father, who for many years unsuccessfully sought to obtain riches. "I have tried and reached much after property and several times obtained it," Solomon Mack recalled in his autobiography, "but by misfortunes, time after time, I lost it." Solomon, like Joseph Sr., was also a universalist who admittedly neglected the commandments and resisted his orthodox wife's importunities until his conversion about 1810. And like her mother, Lucy, patiently, faithfully, and for the most part, silently, bore with her situation. In her history, Lucy says very little about her relationship with her father, probably because for a majority of Lucy's childhood, he was absent from the home, either serving in the military or traveling on business ventures, which possibly explains her attraction to a man who was essentially unavailable to her emotionally. I would also argue that the Smith children were drawn into their parents' marriage in an attempt to save it, first Alvin, then young Joseph. In the years before his untimely death in 1823, Alvin seemed to function almost as a surrogate husband and father. Alvin's industry enabled the Smiths to make the first two payments on their Manchester farm, for which he was a co-signer. He also ran the farm and took charge of constructing the family's house. Alvin's central role is abundantly clear in Lucy's history. Reflecting on the loss of the farm in 1825, Lucy states, "Everything which meets my eyes reminds me of my beloved Alvin. There is scarcely anything that I see which has not passed through the hands of that faithful boy and afterwards been carefully arranged precisely according to his plan by his brothers who survived him." The expansion of Alvin's role is perhaps further evidence of Joseph Sr.'s dysfunctionality. Lacking a strong father, Alvin provided the stability the family system needed in a way particularly understood by firstborn children. Here I allude to the research done by the Bach Institute and the University of Minnesota, which has resulted in a generalized theory of birth order characteristics. According to this research, each child is unconsciously assigned a role depending on their birth order that serves a need of the family system. Their description of firstborns fits well with what we know about Alvin, which can be summarized as follows. Firstborns carry the productivity needs of the family system and react to and identify most with the father, the productivity manager. They respond to the conscious, explicit family rules and emulate the family's dominant themes. Being other-oriented and socially aware, firsts will be most conscious of social norms and images. In words normally expected from a departing father, Alvin took great pains to pass his caretaking role on to his siblings before dying on the 19th of November, 1823. The significance of Alvin's death in the development of Joseph Smith's career as a prophet cannot be overemphasized. The sudden loss of Alvin created a vacuum in the family system, plunging it into a period of serious instability and conflict. This is consistent with the findings of Dr. Murray Bowen, who recognizes that the death of an important child can shake the family equilibrium for years. Bowen describes what she calls an emotional shock wave, or a network of underground aftershocks of serious life events that can occur anywhere in the extended family system in the months or years following serious emotional events in a family. This phenomenon was first detected in multi-generational family research, where a series of major life events occurred in multiple separate members of the extended family in the time interval after the serious illness and death of a significant family member. Further research revealed that some version of this phenomenon appeared in a sufficiently high percentage of all families, and a check for the shockwave is done routinely in all family histories. The symptoms in a shockwave can include the full range of emotional symptoms from mild depression to phobias to psychotic episodes, as well as social dysfunctions such as drinking, failures in school or business, abortions, and the illegitimate births, an increase in accidents, and the full range of behavior disorders. I would suggest that the Smith family experienced an emotional shockwave following Alvin's death that lasted several years, and that this wave was particularly strong because of the tremendously important role Alvin had played. Within a period of 2.5 years following Alvin's death, the Smith family experienced an economic crisis with the loss of the farm in 1825, a religious crisis with the division of the family during the Palmyra Revival of 1824-25, and a legal crisis with Joseph Jr.'s public humiliation at South Bainbridge in March 1826. Perhaps these events were among the aftershocks following Alvin's death, as described by Bowen. One perhaps discerns the power and persistence of this shock wave when more than 3 years later, Joseph Jr. tells his parents of his plans to marry because, as Lucy remembered, he felt so lonely ever since Alvin's death. Religious discussion in the Smith household undoubtedly reached unprecedented intensity when Lucy, Hiram, Samuel, and Sophronia joined Palmyra's Presbyterian Church during the revival of 1824-25. William remembered that during this time, his mother continued her importunities and exertions to interest us in the importance of seeking for the salvation of our immortal souls, until almost all the family became either converted or seriously inclined. Lucy's pressure would have been especially irritating to Joseph Sr., since he harbored ill feelings towards the Reverend Benjamin Stockton, who was the minister of the church. In delivering Alvin's funeral sermon, Stockton imprudently intimated very strongly that he had gone to hell because he was not a member of a denomination. Joseph Sr. was incensed by the minister's remarks and ultimately, as Lucy recorded, refused going anymore, either for my gratification or any other person's. Joseph Sr. could not have been happy that his wife and some of his children had joined the church headed by a minister he so despised. It is likely that Smith family conversation during this period centered on two issues. First, the fate of Alvin. Had Alvin gone to hell, as the minister implied? Did the subsequent membership of Lucy and the others in the Presbyterian Church not imply agreement with the minister concerning Alvin's fate? Or were they perhaps themselves about the matter? Regardless, the matter of Alvin's fate would have greatly raised the stakes in the debate over religion in the Smith household, and would have served to highlight the differences between Joseph Sr.'s universalism and Lucy's Calvinism. Second, the authority of Joseph Sr.'s dream, the first of which occurred in 1811, and Joseph Jr.'s first vision, which Smith said occurred in 1820 or 21. Both had revealed that all religious denominations were spiritually dead and under condemnation. When Lucy joined the Presbyterian Church, she chose to ignore the import of their revelations. Lucy's making a point that neither Joseph nor her husband had forbidden her to join the Presbyterian Church is her way of obscuring the fact that there was conflict over the matter. It only tells us that the two Josephs were not forceful or overtly coercive in their views, or perhaps they were aware of the futility of such an effort, given Lucy's determination. It does not tell us about Lucy's attitude towards the religious views of her husband and son. However, we get an indirect glimpse into Lucy's opinion when she quotes young Joseph saying, "You will not stay with them long, for you are mistaken in them, and you do not know the wickedness of their hearts." This implies conflict as well as resistance on Lucy's part. Even when Joseph prophesies against one of the Presbyterian officials, Lucy admits she was skeptical and surprised when it was fulfilled within the year. Yet, despite the fulfillment of her son's remarkable prediction, she and the others continued to regularly attend the Presbyterian Church until about September 1820. It would take years for the Smith family to achieve a measure of stability and equilibrium, which was largely acquired through the founding of Joseph Smith's church. In performing this function, Smith was responding to the needs of the family system as generally perceived by fourthborns. Fourths feel responsible for the family system as a whole, being especially sensitive to its unification or homeostatic needs. As summarized by Nathalia Zimmerman, Leslie E. Collins, and Jerome M. Bach, their identity and sense of well-being depends to a considerable degree upon the extent to which they succeed in maintaining the dynamic homeostasis of the whole family. Fourth children are the damaging officers of familial and other interpersonal systems, since their feeling of well-being is most vulnerable to tension or pain within the system-wide in its impact. They have also been described as the family radar, picking up and identifying with every action and interaction in the family system. They catch and collect the unresolved family tension, particularly any relational tension in the system. From a behavioral point of view, fourth children feel very responsible, yet powerless and helpless to really do anything about what is going on in the family. They may resort to cutesy mascot-like behavior to distract the family's pain, or become disruptive and thereby become the family's scapegoat. Smith seems to have possessed traits consistent with the foregoing description. Comparing himself to the drunken Noah, Joseph Sr. touches on the damage control concerns of the fourthborn when blessing Joseph Jr. in 1834, saying, "Thou hast stood by thy father, and like Shem, would have covered his nakedness rather than see him exposed to shame." Other concerns of the fourthborn seem reflected in Smith's disclosure that in his youth he possessed a light and too often vain mind, exhibiting a foolish and trifling conversation. One might also remember Smith's confession that when the angel appeared in 1823, he was in the act of repenting for his light-mindedness and levity, revealing also that his disposition was naturally light and cheery. If jocularity was Smith's way of distracting his family's pain, then his occasional neighbors, his public drunkenness, and trouble with the law were possible manifestations of his scapegoating. Interestingly, Smith's family setting is consistent with what is generally known about the lives of imposters. Here I allude to psychiatrist Phyllis Greenacre's 1959 study of several celebrated imposters, which was first brought to bear on the study of Joseph Smith in 1971. I must qualify my use of the term imposter when applied to Joseph Smith, for I do not use the term in quite the same way that Brody and Greenacre do. In fact, I am not interested in debating whether or not Smith was, in the cosmic sense, a true prophet. For even if one concludes Smith constructed fake plates and dictated a contrived history of ancient America, the question remains, could a true prophet, if there is such a thing, use deception to advance God's cause? Perhaps yes. Accordingly, I use the term imposter in the sense that Smith was consciously aware that he did not possess real gold, and although I hold the opinion that Smith constructed plates from scrap tin, which he allowed some individuals to fill through a cloth or heft in a box, I am fully aware that this is far from determining whether or not he was a quote-unquote true prophet. At some level, Smith may have believed he was a prophet, perhaps even inspired to use deception in performing his mission, but his willingness to deceive others, or well-intentioned or not, nevertheless qualifies him as an impostor. He may have been a prophet whatever that means, but perhaps to instill confidence and faith in others, he pretended to be more. Greenacre describes parental conflict as a significant factor in the imposter's development. In those cases in which an early history was attainable, Greenacre observes, the parents were at odds, the mother frequently despising, reproaching, or attacking the father, who either remained detached from the child or removed himself by death or desertion. Greenacre would not have been surprised to discover that Joseph Smith's parents were over religion and that his father was an alcoholic and hence emotionally absent from the family system. The imposter obviously suffers from an identity crisis, which Greenacre describes as a struggle between two dominant identities in the individual, the temporary, focused, and strongly assertive imposterous one, and the frequently amazingly crude and poorly knit one from which the imposter has emerged. In psychoanalytic fashion, Greenacre attempts to discover the possible origin of the imposter's identity problems, which she believes begin in infancy and result from an unusual and intense attachment by the mother. From birth, Greenacre observes, the mother has regarded the infant with extreme possessive and ambivalent concern and constant watchfulness. Whether this appeared as marked anxiety and guilt or as great pride seems less important than the fact that the attachment was extreme, the maternal attachment to which the future imposter is subject, as if he were a part of the mother, undermines his sense of a separate self and the development of his own identity. Given Lucy's increasing alienation from her husband, it is not improbable that she would have sought a closer attachment with her children. The timing of Joseph Smith's birth immediately following the financial and religious crisis in Lucy and Joseph Sr.'s relationship is significant, since the infant Joseph would have been the most available object for Lucy's attachment needs. During young Joseph's 1813 leg operation, Lucy uncontrollably rushed into the room twice and finally had to be detained outside the room until the operation was completed. It is likely that this traumatic event intensified Lucy's attachment to the 6 or 7 year old Joseph. In the Oedipal phase, Greenacre describes the imposter's experiences that believes that the imposter experiences profound frustration due largely to his inability to relieve the normal Oedipal pressures through a positive identification with the father. For this child, she observes, the Oedipal conflict becomes both sharp and insoluble. Greenacre believes that parental conflict is internalized by the child, ultimately becoming one of the compulsive pressures leading to the imposter's career, and, surprisingly, gets played out in the imposture. A purpose of the imposture, notes Greenacre, is the living out of an Oedipal conflict through revival of the earliest definite image of the father. Since the initial form of Joseph's imposture was that of a treasure seer, one can look to the father's example and find that indeed the son's earliest impressions of him were probably that of a treasure-seeking rodsman and visionary dreamer. However, coupled with this image of the inspired dreamer was also the dichotomous image of Joseph Sr. as the drunken, irreligious seeker after worldly treasures, an image that was probably reinforced by Lucy's continued efforts at converting him. Undoubtedly, young Joseph had difficulty synthesizing his father's contradictions. Greenacre describes the imposter's preoccupation with the despised father and how that relationship relates to the imposture itself. Insofar as the imposture is accomplished, it is the symbolic killing of the father through the complete displacement of him. It is indeed striking in the cases of the great imposters of history how much the fraud is clearly directed at the father. Because the imposter might also revive the earliest definite image of the father, Greenacre observes that he does not simply attack and displace the father, but that there can be repeated fluctuation between attack and identification. I would argue that this is precisely the case with Joseph Smith, that the early accounts of Smith's encounters with the angel were told in a treasure-seeking context, or rather in conformity with treasure-seeking expectations, should alert one to the possibility that Smith's imposture was fundamentally directed at his father. I would also argue that Smith's emotional outburst following his father's baptism on the 6th of April, 1830, as described by both Lucy Smith and Joseph Knight, is dramatic evidence that Smith's primary goal had been Joseph Sr. According to Lucy, Joseph stood on the shore when his father came up out of the water. And as he took him by the hand, he cried out, "Oh my God, I have lived to see my father baptized into the true church of Jesus Christ," and covered his face in his father's bosom and wept aloud for joy. I would suggest that Smith's relief was equal only to the original concern he had for his father. Obviously, Joseph Smith identified with his father's spiritual gifts, both as a treasure seeker and visionary, but like so many children of alcoholics, he also identified with his father's pain to the extent that he too struggled with excessive drinking. Nevertheless, through his translation of the Book of Mormon and founding of the Church of Christ, Smith superseded and displaced his father as the spiritual leader of the family. Given Joseph Smith's family situation, it is not surprising to find fragments of disguised autobiography in the Book of Mormon. It was fitting that Joseph Smith began his book with a family that in many ways was comparable to his own. Both families left the land of their inheritance to find a land of promise, and both were severely conflicted over religion, particularly the validity of the father's visions. Like Smith's father, Lehi received several visions, mostly in dreams. One of Lehi's dreams, one in which his family struggles to reach the tree of life amid the scorn of the world, is remarkably similar to a dream that Lucy remembered Joseph Sr. having about 1813, only that some of Lehi's children do not make it to the tree. Thus, Smith transformed his father's dream of family unity into the reality of family division. Like Smith, Nephi, Lehi's fourth son, is an ardent defender of his father's dreams. The two oldest sons, Laman and Lemuel, on the other hand, reject Lehi's dreams and regard them as nothing more than the foolish imaginations of his heart. Even Lehi's wife, Sariah, complained against him, disparagingly calling him a visionary man. Like Joseph Sr., Lehi was blamed for the unnecessary loss of the family's inheritance. However, Nephi never fails his father, and with Brother Sam endures abuse and harassment from the older brothers. Identification with and displacement of the father is also evident in the story of Lehi and Nephi. Nephi not only defends his father's dreams, but soon becomes a visionary in his own right, and it is not long before he excels his father in visions and scriptural interpretation, even becoming the interpreter of his father's dreams. Interestingly, Nephi not only expounds the meaning of his father's tree of life dream, but in one instance adds to and clarifies it, pointing out that his father had overlooked the filthiness of the river of water, which Nephi interprets as a representation of that awful hell, which the angel said unto me was prepared for the wicked. Thus Smith not only transformed his father's dream into the reality of family division, but interpreted it in a way that was inconsistent with Joseph Sr.'s universalism. In fact, throughout the Book of Mormon, there is a sustained attack on the concept of universal salvation, which Smith likely interpreted as the source of his family's troubles. In his final exhortation to his family, shortly before his death, Lehi declares that there is an eternal gulf of misery and woe, suggesting that he had accepted Nephi's interpretation of the river of water. This perhaps reflects Smith's own wish that his aging father would also abandon universalism, accept his gifted son's reinterpretations of his dreams, and repent before it is too late. Where Lehi possibly represents the idealized, inspired dreamer father, the side of Joseph Sr. with which Smith wished to identify. The drunken Laban might represent the other side of Joseph Sr., the side that Smith most hated about his father and wished to eradicate. Though Nephi hesitated to kill Laban with his own sword, the Spirit convinced him that it was according to God's will, reasoning that the Jewish official's death would enable him to get possession of the brass plates containing the Hebrew scriptures, and thereby prevent the Nephite nation from perishing in unbelief. In other words, the commandment to commit no murder had to be violated so that a greater good might be accomplished, that of bringing many souls into God's kingdom. Symbolically, Nephi's encounter with Laban perhaps represents Smith's wish to free the Bible from the evil father's control and hand it over to the inspired dreamer father and thereby save his family. The act of beheading, therefore, might reflect Smith's wish to put an end to Joseph Sr.'s intellectualization of the Bible, a tendency he had inherited from his father Aziel and reinforced by his leanings towards Unitarian Universalism. At any rate, Nephi, like Smith, replaces his father as the spiritual leader of the family. Only Nephi remains faithful, while Lehi is truly chastened because of his murmuring against the Lord. This dynamic also appears in Moroni's abridgment of the Book of Ether, particularly in the stories of Kib and Omer. In both stories, the father kings are overthrown by one of their sons and subsequently restored by a younger. This theme also appears in disguised form in several additional stories in Ether. And throughout Jaredite history, firstborn inheritance is consistently ignored in favor of a younger son's succession to the throne. An interesting aspect to succession in the Book of Ether is that these younger sons always succeed their fathers while they are still living and with their consent. Applied to Smith's family situation, Smith apparently wished to restore his father as leader and patriarch of the family, then, with the latter's blessing, succeed him. To summarize, I would argue that in response to the combined pressure of Alvin's death and the demands of his family role, Smith scapegoated himself in a variety of ways in an attempt to restore balance to his family. A major obstacle to uniting his family religiously was his father's dream visions, which had convinced him to remain independent of the existing churches. Founding a new church fulfilled Joseph Sr.'s expectations and allowed him to participate without denying his dreams, while the contents of the Book of Mormon perhaps caused him to reassess his universalism. Early in the translation, Joseph Sr. learned from King Benjamin that those like Alvin, those who have died not knowing the will of God concerning them, were saved through Jesus' atonement. Thus, it was no longer necessary for him to adhere to universalist doctrine in order to save Alvin. And Lucy and the others could belong to a church without consigning their beloved Alvin to hell. Regardless, the final result was that Smith united his family within his newly founded church. Something of Smith's self-perception came through in his angry response to criticism from Brother William in 1835. I brought salvation to my father's house as an instrument in the hands of God when they were in a miserable situation. Smith could not give the family the social status that Alvin had, but he nevertheless managed to resolve their religious crisis and improve their worldly situation. Thank you.
Well, it's a privilege to respond to Dan's paper. I had a chance to read an early draft some months ago and am pleased to review again what he's just presented. I really think this is an excellent paper. It should be published. I think it has made a major step in the advancement of our knowledge of Joseph Smith and his life. And I think that's for a number of reasons. First, I really have to confess that after 30 years in psychiatry and psychoanalysis, I have to admit that we are still a long way off from really a good scientific
theory and practice of human behavior. But we're on the way. Unfortunately, psychoanalysis is really still valid, very helpful, but in essence, it is still a folk psychology on the way to an attempted scientific way to really observe factually what goes on within the individual and the family. It's just a little bit better folk psychology than most religions. And again, I don't say this in any pejorative way. Basically, we should be very grateful for the religious traditions of all times, because they have given us a means by which we as human beings have the way to live and connect with the universe. But and remember, folk psychology is very helpful. It's a rule of thumb. It helps. It works in many cases. The problem is there's so darn many exceptions. And I'll say more about that, specifically about Dan's paper, in terms of some of the psychoanalytic formulations from Phyllis Greenacre. I myself have spent the last 4 or 5 years in the study of family systems, in attempting now to move on and integrate the many remarkable contributions of psychoanalysis and psychodynamic psychiatry onto what I think the 21st century will bring us to, and that is a theory of human behavior that I think we'll all live to see, certainly our grandchildren and grandchildren will be, that will be moving at least in the direction of what Dan has tapped into, and that is family systems. Again, I don't think it has arrived at all the answers, but it's on the way, certainly on the way more than approach that I have come across. And I'd like to underscore the word systems, because it's really in a systems way now that we have to look at human beings. The old idea of just looking at the individual, either from an intrapsychic deep point of view, such as people like Freud and Jung and others did, is just simply too limiting. And what Dan has done is quote some of the very relevant authors and researchers in this area. And I commend him very much for it. Dan and I recall very much, have had some great conversations going through so many of the aspects of the Smith family that have been very, very meaningful. I certainly agree with most of his findings. What I admire Dan so much about is he's always been able to find more of the data than I ever could in terms of his prodigious research. Let me just say a few words, though, and I don't want to take a lot of time because I know there'll be lots of questions, but one, I'd like to just emphasize several areas. First of all, the idea that he starts out with, Framo's quote concerning the family system as a unit. Murray Bowen, of course, the founder of family systems, really said that and amplified that better than anyone. And that really is the hardest concept. If there's any other thing you take away from anything I say, it would be this. The most difficult concept, as I see, in terms of systems thinking, is to be able to see a family as a unit and not each individual playing their just their individual parts. You may think that's easy, but it isn't. And that's what the assumption is in the systemic approach here that we're looking at. So, in other words, what we're saying is that every major event in the Smith family is related to every other event. There is no simple single cause and effect that brings about this. One has to look at all the systemic factors. And more specifically, I'd like to just focus on Dan's highlighting of the Joseph Smith Sr., Lucy Mack Smith relationship and their dysfunctional relationship, which, of course, is at the core of the family and, of course, is at the core of the disharmony and the homeostatic process that was being disrupted. And again, that really is one of the key concepts behind systems thinking, is any system you look at, you try to see how is it staying in balance at this particular pull right into to that whole relationship when Alvin died, and perhaps even before. Here again, family systems, Dan did not touch on this, and that is that it raises the notion, as Bowen has taught us, about the triangle. To me, I cannot believe that after 30 years in psychiatry and psychoanalysis that we have been so blinded to fail to understand the concept of the triangle. I guess because we focus so much on the individual, or now it's taken psychoanalysis 75 years to get to a two-party relationship, finally we're beginning to look at the three-party relationship. And if we look at that triangle, what killed Alvin challenged Joseph. And in essence, what Joseph did was attempt then to balance out that relationship. Dan's final statement, where he summarized what Joseph did for his family, is a remarkable statement. And that really needs to be enshrined in the paper. How he brought together resolving the conflicts of the father with the dreams and visions and his religious views, as well as mother's views and her more down-to-earth, more practical, conventional-oriented religious views. And, of course, it all centered around Alvin and his death. I would say that from a personal point of view, Mormonism arose out of the attempt of young Joseph to be the mediator in his family to reestablish Alvin and the meaning of his death for that family. And I think it's a remarkable thing. It certainly doesn't diminish any of the other aspects that come out of Joseph's remarkable creative genius. I think then this, and there's not enough time to develop this, but and I hope I have some more work on this myself that I intend to publish, and that is that Joseph's own conflicts then stands at the center of that triangle. On the one hand, I think as Dan has so cogently pointed out, there was that early fusion relationship with his mother with the leg operation, and a tremendous affectivity of that child-mother bond that he never really got over. And this, of course, led to the great struggles he had in trying to please his mother, as well as later his wife Emma. But yet, it was a disturbed and difficult and dysfunctional relationship that he never really resolved. And I think that led to his other problems with women. And anybody who doesn't think Joseph Smith had problems with women, they'd better go back and do a little studying. On the other hand, with his father, as Dan has spent more time emphasizing, he had problems there too. Again, I think he got lost a bit in all the theorizing about the father-son conflict. Valuable as that is, I think it can distort one from the whole issue of the balance. You see, he was attempting then to fulfill what he needed to do with his father and yet please his mother. And that's where he went. It was a great challenge for the individuation self-differentiation process. Joseph did well with it. He was a creative genius. But he had split and neurotic problems to the end of his life over this issue. In other words, I would submit that Joseph's problem is no different than any one of our problems. Basically, the greatest challenge for anyone's individual identity is how do you resolve and balance that original triangle in that relationship you have with your father and your mother. And that really is one of the most important stories of family systems. Finally, a comment about the problems with the paper, and that is the imposter issue raised by Phyllis Greenher. I would suggest, Dan, that you really drop that. I think the imposter concept is just too problematical. Number one, I don't think Joseph was an imposter, unless you call all the shamans in the world imposters. Certainly he may have utilized certain techniques about the plates, etc., that we don't see from a religious point of view, but I don't think that one can see that is an imposter, being an imposter, from the religious context. Again, I think what we have to have here is Michael Quinn's tremendously marvelous study on the magic worldview to get that picture of that whole cultural milieu that Joseph and his father grew up in and how they reasoned. And it fits in very, very, very well and very justifiably so. Certainly later there were shifts in the religious interpretation of that, but I really think that that's lost in its meaning. Phyllis Greenacre, of course, is a classical psychoanalyst. Long ago in the 50s, she wrote this paper. And so much of this, again, is great folk psychology. I can show you cases I have treated in which the whole imposter psychodynamic she articulates and Dan went through are true with people who end up with schizophrenia, manic depression, and all sorts of other syndromes besides imposturing. That's the problem with classical and other traditional psychoanalytic interpretations, including Jung. And that is, it's great to explain an individual situation, but it is not comprehensive enough to give you a wide enough view to really explain this specific behavior. I mean, as an example, you can take two children in the same family with two parents. One is schizophrenic and totally dysfunctional, and the other is remarkably well. How do you explain that? They virtually have the same mothering and fathering, supposedly. Well, again, classical psychoanalytic theory and other theories of this nature that include only one- or two-party systems cannot explain it. Family systems with the concept of the triangle can begin to approach it. But in all, as I say, I think it was a marvelous paper. I hope that you'll all get a chance to read it when it's published. And for one, I, for one, am grateful Dan has done such a good job. Thank you very much.
Well, I trust you feel enlightened and refreshed with some very new kinds of thinking out of these talks. Let's move to your questions as quickly as possible. If you'll, if you're up here close and want to ask a question, you can come right up to the microphone. We need to get them on tape, so I will repeat them if they're from further back. And let's, in the interest of time, let's avoid speech making. But let's get some questions to these gentlemen. Dan, the question is whether Joseph's limp, which has been reported over the years, came from the leg injury or from a fight with William.
Yeah, it was the leg injury. You were right the first time.
The leg injury was caused by the operation or the fight with William?
Yeah, he had a slight limp all his life. The fight with William happened many years later. So, yeah, you were right the first time.
Put an Alvin dial.
I wish we had that. no, Alvin... died of an intestinal blockage that developed into gangrene. Died a slow, miserable, painful, horrible death. In 1823, and he was born in 1797, something like that. Yeah. So, horrible, though.
Please, if Perry.
Riveted in your brain. What was your best evidence of tracking Joseph Smith drinking throughout his life? The church tends to sanitize most of their versions, but where do you see your sources?
Question to Dan is sources with respect to Joseph Smith drinking.
Well, there's the Palmyra testimony of the neighbors. The eyewitness, gentleman testified he saw Joseph Smith get drunk and get in a fight, you know, with a neighbor. And Emma, it was right after they got married, so it was 1827. Emma had to take him, put her shawl over him because he tore his shirt and take him home, you know. I don't think he was constantly drunk or anything, but he had episodes. And there's stories of Joseph Smith drinking in Kirtland and Nauvoo. When you look at the different statements that have been made, and I don't feel like I have to assign each one to anti-Mormon sentiment or anything. He wasn't your modern Mormon who has this thing about absolutely no drinking and they drank when they worked in the fields. It was supposed to be a good thing to drink a little whiskey and water. Stuff like that. So it's there. You have to dig. It's not hard to find, really.
Please, over here.
Dan, I'm a little troubled by what kind of expectations you have for this model to explain Joseph Smith. If you intend to do that in a strong or weak fashion, or just provide interpretation or insight into his life. But the question I have is looking at the family being disrupted by Alvin's death, certainly the family there was another perturbation in Joseph Smith's mission. And if you follow the family system's, you know, method into looking at the family's response to Joseph Smith's prophetic mission, what insights can we get there?
Okay, the question is to Dan, first, where he really wants to go with this model, and secondly, how the specific mission of Joseph Smith may fit into this model as compared to the Alvin factor, which he's already talked about.
Well, all I'll say is that I don't think one model is the answer to everything. You know, there's many, many perspectives that bear on it. And I would I feel more secure with the family systems because it's more... evidential, you know, you can just like when you study, cultures or societies, you just study the family as a smaller version of that sort of sociological approach to the family. And then I bring in the psychoanalytic stuff, which is a little more nebulous, as you know, kind of to show how they kind of all converge on a kind of a similar picture. And but I don't understand the second part of the question, really.
Try to say it again. There was one disturbance in the family. It was Alvin's death.
Yeah.
And you interpreted Joseph's prophetic mission as an attempt to bring stability back to the family. In other respects, Joseph's prophetic mission served as further disturbance of the family.
Yeah.
And did it succeed in bringing stability to the family? How did the family respond to that? And I was asking if there are any insights you had about that further playing out of family systems within the family.
All I can say is that William didn't quite go with the program that Joseph laid out and resented the control he had, you know, and responded to it more than once. That's why I quoted Joseph responding to William, that he was the savior of the family and he did a good thing. And he says to William, if you think I'm a false prophet, just leave me to God, you know, and don't try to, you know, take it away or something, you know. I'm not sure. I'll leave that up to other scholars to do the rest of the Justinian's life. Right now I'm just focusing on the beginning. I don't know if that answers your question, you know.
I think we have time for just one more here, and now I'm seeing several hands. Elaine, let's get your question. Question is about possible depression and bipolar disorder within the Smith family.
Well, Jess and Larry Foster have put forth the idea that there is a genetic predisposition towards depression. I don't really buy it. And I go with Bob Anderson's kind of analysis of that thesis. Jess probably doesn't agree with Bob Anderson's analysis of it. But I really don't think Joseph suffered a depressed day in his life, probably, you know. If it goes through his family, it must have missed him.
Jess, do you want to comment on that? That I think, is ongoing interest.
Yeah, that's a huge topic. Well, I do think that Joseph was depressed. I've read Bob Anderson, a good friend of mine. We went to medical school and talked about this many times. But basically, I do think Joseph was depressed. But I think Dan is correct in a way. He didn't have a lot of depressed days because I think most of the time he was manic. But actually, that's a little strong, too. Probably Joseph was not a full-blown bipolar. There are grades of bipolar disease, bipolar 1, 2, and even 3. Again, the genetic thing, I would emphasize, that's part of it, but there's a whole series here. Again, looking in family systems, if you look at the history of the Smith family, both Smith and Mack family, there's depression right on through from the grandparents, at least to the parents, Joseph's father, mother, and then Joseph himself, I think, see, many people who become a bit manic defend against depression. And then when you look at Joseph's children and Joseph's depression, I think Mike Quinn has described Joseph's depression in the last days of his life. I think, of course, you could say that's situational. But when you look at his children, some of those descendants, it's really astounding where you see a whole family system history of depression. So I think there's a lot of evidence for it. But it's a complex argument, and I don't think just disagreeing or agreeing about whether he was is bipolar is the issue. That's certainly a point. I would say he was probably a bipolar too. But maybe not as much as Bob Anderson is saying, but anyway, I think the depression issue is there, and it can be shown with a lot of evidence.
Unfortunately, we are out of time for this session. There will be 15 minutes until the next session starts. I'm sure that these presenters would be interested in discussing topics further with you individually. Thank you for your participation, for your questions.